and welcome to Earth Heart Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition that we do every Tuesday live from 1 to 2 p.m. How are you doing? Lisa Almaraz here with you, your host, and glad to be joining you this beautiful, very cold day. Wow, we've got the polar vortex all vorticizing around us down here in the mountains, and it is extremely cold. We actually have below zero wind chill factors going on, so keep those little critters and children and family members and everybody safe from the wind. It's a little windy and it can be very chilling, dangerously chilling, in fact. So watch out for the little combs on your roosters, you know, make sure your chickens are okay and things like that. So gotta watch out because sometimes we just don't realize quite how cold it is. And after going this morning outdoors just for a minute, oh, it was so cold. So cold. So yes, winter is definitely here and settling in nicely, and we are plowing through into the new year, enjoying it, being part of a whole new year of education that we'll be sharing at Living Web Farms. It's very exciting. Tonight, we actually have a workshop on pro knife skills for home cooks, and that's a very important skill to have, not only for your own safety, but also to enjoy being able to cut and prepare things beautifully as we make delicious organic food. So keeping it up, knowing about how to get rid of those dull edges, slow preparations, and learning how to wield a knife like a real chef, get those cutting techniques down. We're going to do that tonight there at Mills River Educational Farm. You can go online and register right now to join us for this event tonight from 6 to 7:30. Well, we've always got cutting-edge news information, and then we also have some exciting guests that join us every once in a while, depending on what we're doing to help promote things going on, some of the learning opportunities here in the mountains, things like Organic Grower School coming up, or the Carolina Farm Stewardship Association Sustainable Agriculture Conference that happens in the fall. And there are many ongoing educational opportunities all over the mountains. And one of the great places that you can go to learn from fantastic teachers, aside from Living Web Farms and all of the other places, is Ash Village. And Ash Village Institute, they've got the Resilient Living School. And we are going to be talking to Janelle Kapoor today. She is the founder there at Ash Village Institute and the school they've got going. And they've got many different programs. They've got an 8-month long Resilient Living School program that runs from April until November with an 8-week residency happening. That's in Asheville coming up this year, April 2nd to November 16th. And the residency happening from April 2nd to May 26th. That's a very big commitment for a year-long, you know, all through the year, really 8-month-long program. Then they have a Resilient Living Workshop that's a week-long, and that's a week-long event. And then you've got the Permaculture School, which is 12 months that runs all through the year there with a 12-week residency that happens right near Asheville. And the Permaculture Design Course coming up in June, and other permaculture workshops about 3.5 days each. And you can check it all out at ashvillage.org. Ashvillage.org is the website where everything is detailed. That's A-S-H-E, village.org. Spelled just like Asheville. Add that little E in there. And so it'll be fun. We'll be talking to Janelle. I ran into her the other day while shopping at our local nonprofit grocery store. Members shop there, and non-members too, the French Broad Food Co-op. Right there at 90 Biltmore Avenue, you can support the French Broad Food Co-op by being a member. You can also shop there even if you are not. But that is a place where you find all organic produce, lots of local products, and a real community hub. So as I was moving through the bulk room, I said hello to Janelle and invited her on the show so we can learn more about her wonderful programs that happen throughout the year here in the Asheville area. Well, cutting-edge news and information, that's what we do. Yes, we talk about very compelling things where the issues of food and farming and gardening and health and the climate and everything comes together in synergy. When we really get reconnected to the land and our food and our health, it changes everything. You know, I'm always saddened when I see friends of mine out in the world or friends on Facebook or whatever, old friends from many years, and they're very unconscious about their diet, you know, or not conscious at least of the effects that what you eat have on your body. They eat, you know, emotionally driven eating choices like you know, sentimental choices, maybe something that someone made while you were a kid or something, but maybe it's really not healthy to eat anymore because maybe the ingredients aren't so good, they're not organic, or it's just an unhealthy dish and not enough vegetables, not enough raw food. The typical American diet makes people sick, and sicker than we've ever been. And it just saddens me when I see friends of mine out there talking about, quote unquote, their bad health, or, oh, my bad health, and they're over there eating just piles of junk. And you know what? It affects us. The food totally affects our body's ability to heal. We give it those raw materials, and the body can heal and do amazing things. And the foods are wondrous. There are wonderful medicinal foods out there. As Hippocrates said, let food be your medicine and medicine be your food. And that is what we can do. We can eat more sprouts, more delicious salads. Of course, choose all organic. Eat more greens in general, right? More beans, more fiber that is non-meat type proteins that you can get that really help you feel better, help you whoosh out those toxins. You know, food is our path of healing when we're doing it and celebrating it in a way that supports us. But eating food to satisfy some, you know, pit of emotional need, or unconsciously, or because it's on a commercial, or because you saw it, you know, in an ad or something, you know, those are the unhealthy food products that cost us our health. And so, you know, I just encourage you to really make it a big deal to go organic this year. And you can get lots of support from Organic Consumers Association. They are wonderful. And lots of wonderful news I get there as well all the time. Organicconsumers.org. Stay up to date. Stay up to date on what they're offering as far as news, and also great opportunities to sign petitions and let your voice be heard on some of these great issues. Many great petition sites out there, or people taking action on different sites now. And, you know, you can be part of it as well as making those organic choices at home. And I wanted to share a great story from Organic Consumers Association that they've just come out with here today about certain doctors at a medical school realizing the connection of diet and how important it is. And it's a great new program. You can learn about it more at orgcns.org, orgcns.org. It is Tulane University School of Medicine in New Orleans, along with 16 other medical schools, is implementing a very different curriculum than what they've had before, teaching their medical students not only about nutrition in general, but also the practical aspects of cooking with real ingredients. It's an inspiring program. Finally, doctors are starting to learn about diet instead of just maybe only pushing drugs and surgery, which is what has been typical. We've overdone it, right? We've wiped out our microbiome, healthy guts with tons of different antibiotic prescriptions, over-prescriptions of antibiotics. Now we've got the medical establishment admitting millions of people have been falsely treated for cancer. We've got a 3% rate of treatment on that when it comes to radiation chemotherapy. But what do? When we can heal ourselves, let's get rid of those acidic states that promote cancer in the body. Let's get away from all of the toxic input that we are so unconscious of as we flood ourselves with technology in the world while we're eating food covered in pesticides. Right? We've got to be thinking about these things and doing it a little differently. And it doesn't matter if that's not what everyone else is doing. Sometimes just being aware and doing your homework, doing your research, and figuring out what's healthier, you're ahead of the pack when you do that. You're not one of those masses of unconscious people anymore that's just eating whatever, doing whatever, and then feeling horrible. You wake up and you do things differently, and sometimes maybe there's not a crowd with you doing it. But that's okay. It's okay to be on the cutting edge. It's okay to feel better and to go for it with healthier food choices. Great to see. We've got all kinds of things out there promoting unhealthy choices. And, you know, we've got right now about 70% of Americans taking prescription drugs. And, you know, prescription drugs are like the one thing it says it does, and then the 50 other things that it does that are detrimental to you. Right? Plants and natural remedies do not have that other list of side effects that are damaging and even life-threatening and deadly. They don't have that, right? And we've synthesized the natural things and patented them so that the big pharma companies can make the huge amounts of money. But meanwhile, we get all of those added negative effects when we could just go straight to nature And no, it's not a huge multi-billion dollar proposition to go out there and grow a little spinach, but it's a lot healthier than eating a bunch of prescription drugs with a ton of horrible side effects. And when people say medication, it's not medicine. Medicine heals. Food is medicine. Food is healing. Natural medicine given to us by nature and thousands of years of heirlooms and things that have grown and are adapted to disease and have tons of nutrition. Being able to go direct to being healthy right there, that land-to-mouth connection right there from the healthy soil to the healthy food you're eating to the healthy life you're living, that is our natural ability to just get out there and do. We weren't born to go take a bunch of synthetic chemicals to help us. As I was saying, they aren't medicine. Medicine is healing. Food is medicine. Natural medicine, not prescriptions. Prescriptions are drugs. They're drugging people. It's not healing, right? It doesn't heal. You know, I have family members that take certain drugs to do certain things because of certain conditions that they've had or whatever, and they don't ever not take them. It doesn't heal them of whatever it is. It's a drug to keep promoting whatever it does in the body. It doesn't heal. It's not medicine, right? I like to take back the lexicon because words are important. And it's critical to use the correct terminology when we refer to things. And it's important to take our perspective and free it from the misuse of terminology. We've had, you know, lexicon being trashed and disempowered and words being misused. And we've got to take back our language, our consciousness, our diet, and quit falling for the fake stuff, right? The fake food, the fake people, the fake lifestyles. And get back to authenticity and true values that actually uplift us, that fortify us, that strengthen us, that make us healthier, truly healthier. So great to see that there are opportunities to do that all over the place. As I mentioned, about 70% of Americans are taking prescription drugs right now. And some of them are really dangerous drug cocktails that are the outcome of unhealthy relationships between large pharmaceutical companies and doctors because they are making money off of this stuff and they're combining all kinds of wild things out there. And yes, you get prescribed these things and they're not really good. And all you've got to do is get your physician's desk reference and read all of the effects of what you're being given and not just popping it in there. Right? You've got to have that land-to-mouth food, farm, and garden connection going on even with everything you're eating, everything. And we've got to be able to do our own research and read labels. I was glad to announce Campbell's is going to be labeling their GMOs. That's a great thing to see. Of course, we want to see, I personally would like to see the GMOs banned because they cause all kinds of problems and also have to use a ton of pesticides. We were told we wouldn't need as many pesticides with the use of GMOs. It's not true. And there are a ton of research studies out there that show that they are not so safe. But those studies are buried, attacked, hidden. But they're out there, and I don't consider them safe myself. I don't eat them. I try to avoid them as much as I can. And, you know, meanwhile, we look around, and what have we been having? Just epidemic rates of cancer going through the roof, right? Just this last week and a half, we've had so many famous people die of cancer. It's really startling. Latest yesterday was the guy from the Eagles, right? The other singer, Don Henley, was giving a dedication to him, and Glenn Frey. Glenn Frey, great artist, great singer. Died of cancer. Of course, David Bowie this week, of course. Then Alan Rickman from Harry Potter. We've got all kinds of people in the just, and it's cancer across the board. Well, when you add up all of the things that are carcinogenic in our environment, including glyphosate and Roundup, the most widely distributed pesticide in the world, we're still allowing that stuff to be out there. It's sitting on shelves right now all over cities, everywhere, in stores. It's, you know, it's down at Lowe's, it's down at Home Depot, it's down at Walmart, it's everywhere. Piles and piles of it, and people can just walk up and blow that stuff everywhere. It's highly carcinogenic. MIT scientists are calling it one of the, if not the most damaging compound out there than one of the absolutely most dangerous compounds out there. It's rife in our society. It's in the water. It's in unborn babies, uterine fluid. I mean, it is in the soil. It's in the food. It's in our organs. It's all over. And we're being inundated with it. And we know it's carcinogenic. Los Angeles County is suing Monsanto. They've known for 40 years. They have hidden the information. We were told that only the enzyme in the plant was affected and it was safe for us. Not true. It totally affects mammalian red blood cells extremely. And we need to ban Roundup right now. We need to ban Roundup right now. And I've been saying this for a few years. We really do need to go ahead and ban these things. And the neonicotinoids are also killing our pollinators. All of these various poisons that we seem to just turn the other way and allow to be spewed all around us are affecting us. And they're certainly affecting the bees that are helping to keep our food supply going. And they're affecting everything. They're affecting our ability to function. And I would invite you to hop on over and add your voice to GMO Free USA's wonderful petition that says ban Roundup now, because that's what we need to do. You know, we can stand up there, and we've seen it. You know, there's a lot of remorse and a lot of condolences going around for everybody dying of cancer. And we have even our own President Obama standing up and saying, hey, you know, it's so sad to see this tragedy going on. But, you know, we can only say that to the extent that we're realizing what we're doing and then change that. So we've got all these carcinogenic compounds out there. We need to ban them so we're not standing there with our hands folded up while we're spewing all this stuff and it's causing more and more and more and more cancer all over the place. So please take action. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to ban the use and sale of Roundup immediately. GMO Free USA has got it. It's at Salsa Labs. This is a great petition. Look up GMO Free USA. Ban Roundup now. Petition, it's great. We need to ban this stuff. And we cannot wait around for a company that hid the dangerous effects of these chemicals for 40 years to take action and take it off the market. Clearly, there's unethical business practices going on there that's poisoning the public. Monsanto is being tried for international, you know, for crimes against humanity and nature in the International Court of The Hague. We don't have time. We can't sit around waiting for them to take it off the shelf. Clearly, we cannot wait for that. We are connected to this great web of life that we are putrefying. We've got to clean it up, right? We've got to clean it up and have fun doing it. I think it's great. I think it's great to have fun being earth stewards and having fun doing good things together. But this petition says, Dear President Obama, during your most recent State of the Union address, you vowed to utilize the full spectrum of the U.S. government's resources to create a moonshot-like effort geared toward finding a cure for cancer. We wholeheartedly agree this is an issue of grave importance for all Americans, especially those whose lives have been touched by the devastation that a cancer diagnosis can bring to our families, our friends, and coworkers. If we are going to seriously address the ravages of cancer upon human health, there can be no better place to start than by ridding our food system of carcinogenic chemicals that are routinely sprayed on the food that we eat and feed to our children. And this goes on describing more things, you know, and you can be informed. You can stay in touch with organizations like this. They're doing wonderful work. I'll continue just a little further. It says, in March of 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the world's leading authority on carcinogenicity, announced that after a lengthy review of all the relevant scientific evidence, they have classified glyphosate, yes, Roundup, as a probable human carcinogen. Unfortunately, the use and abuse of glyphosate is widespread within our food system, and we urge you to issue an executive order immediately suspending all sales of Roundup in the U.S. from its use on GMO crops, 90% of which are engineered to withstand repeated high doses of Roundup, which pollute our soils and our water supply and us. It's used as a desiccant on many conventional grains to dry them out for harvest. It's ubiquitous in our food system, our waterways, even in our urine and breast milk. Therefore, we hereby request take action today to protect our health and our environment by banning the sale and use of glyphosate immediately. We are overdue. We are overdue to clean up our act when it comes to chemicalized agriculture that kills the soil. The very vitality of the soil is what determines the quality of the food that is grown in it. And zapping the vitality, decimating the vitality of soil, ruins our food quality. And we've got to take the soil back. We've got to reinvigorate the microbes in the soil. We've got to reinvigorate the microbial community in our gut, the microbiome that we're learning so much about that directly correlates to brain function. We cannot be walking around eating food products that cause gut dysbiosis, which basically causes all kinds of everything from mental, emotional problems to immune system problems, you name it. Every disease you could possibly not want, you can get by having gut dysbiosis. All kinds of different symptoms. And you can't really point to one certain thing. It's like, what is this? Well, gut dysbiosis causes a whole spectrum of health problems. And that's why we have to honor our little microbes in our gut. We've got to promote the biodiversity of those microbes because that is what helps us be healthy and well and able to contribute good things in our world. Because we've got to have healthy bodies to be able to function. We've got to be able to have the energy to get up and go out there and do well. So take that opportunity, add your voice. Let's ban Roundup already, please. GMO-free USA petition. Get on there, okay? I'm going to do it right away here. Let me see. Okay, I'm going to get this signed up. I encourage you to do the same. More news here on Earth Heart Network Radio as we move more toward soil, not oil. And there's a whole coalition out there, the Soil Not Oil Coalition. They've had a conference this year. We've got to be rebuilding the soil, sequestering more carbon, not digging up the carbon and spewing it everywhere. The Soil Not Oil Coalition is very happy to be advocating for sustainable and regenerative management of soils worldwide while reducing dependency on fossil fuels. The Soil Not Oil campaign promotes respect for soils worldwide, highlights the way that shifting agricultural practices is key to combating climate change, and they're calling for integrated action on sustainable agriculture and clean energy to ensure a safe and healthy planet for generations to come. It's wonderful to see Soil Not Oil Coalition out there because they get it. They get what we're talking about taking the soil and respecting it and honoring the life in the soil and our own life in our own gut that is related directly to the vital soil. And it's so great to see them coming together, partnering with dozens of other kindred organizations. The Biosafety Alliance is calling on all like-minded organizations, scientists, farmers, individuals to join the Soil Not Oil Coalition and participate in their educational campaign. It's going on. Global food security of the future generations is at risk. The Soil Not Oil Coalition is doing wonderful work out there, and they have been restructuring land management practices, looking to work with changing that conversation on climate change by sequestering carbon with more green everywhere, restoring water cycles, reducing global environmental pollution, stopping ocean acidification, working on reestablishing biodiversity, improving food production, and revitalizing local economies. That's the kind of work we're here to do, right? We don't need to be putting a ton of effort into producing poisons that are making us sick, right? We've got to be putting a ton of effort into having fun, being Earth stewards, and restoring life, the beautiful web of life, restoring our place in the world. I'm very happy to see this kind of work going on, because these are the kind of folks out there that are really forging ahead, blazing trails for the kind of sustainable future we can all share and celebrate. And thank you to Dr. Vandana Shiva. She was the keynote speaker there this year at the conference, Making Peace with the Earth. That was her. She has a message from Earth Day. And, you know, lots of people are out there doing wonderful work to help this move ahead. 95% of our food is directly or indirectly produced on our soils and the essential nutrients it contains. And if our soils are depleted, so is our food. Even if it looks perfect, it's not going to be nutrient dense if we come from nuked soil, It's, you know, soil that's been poisoned is not going to produce healthy food. In the United States, 400 gallons of oil equivalents are expended annually to feed each American. This was as of data provided and gathered back in 94. Agricultural energy consumption is broken down as follows. 31% of agricultural energy consumption is for the manufacture of inorganic fertilizer. So we're spending about a third of all our energy in agriculture just to produce toxins that are messing up our soil. Because these inorganic fertilizers are messing up the soil. And they cause dysfunctional relationships in the soil. And they harm the soil. They kill the microbes. So we're spending about a third of our energy to cause most of our problems. Not even really helping us. We think we're helping, right? We're doing this temporary burst of growth and making non-nutritious food. But meanwhile, that's 31% of the energy. 19% of the energy in agriculture is spent for the operation of field machinery. 16% for transportation, hauling the food around from wherever it grew. That's why we've got to keep it local. 13% is spent on irrigation. 8% for raising livestock, not including the livestock feed, and that number would be higher in that case. 5% for crop drying, and some of that crop drying is just, hey, let's spray some Roundup and it'll dry it out. And then make bread out of it. And everybody's got all this, oh, I got to be gluten-free. Well, really, you got to be Roundup free. You know, we get heavy-duty gut dysbiosis happening when we're eating glyphosate. That doesn't work, right? It messes up our digestion. We've got about 5% of the energy in agricultural energy consumption for pesticide production and 8% miscellaneous. We're not even proportioning our energy costs in a way that is sustainable at all. And it produces inferior food products. Doesn't sound like, you know, something we would be promoting. So we've got to be able to switch this around and grow more organic food all over the place. Today, the world burns 400 years worth. This is so staggering. Today, the world burns 400 years worth of accumulated biological matter every year. And we're at about 300 to 400% more than we were in 1956 when it comes to burning hundreds of years of accumulated biological matter. We're just burning up the earth, eating up our resources. We've got to restore the land and the soil, rebuild the soil, rebuild our health. Good soil management can prevent damaging erosion, loss of organic matter, soil compaction, and degradation of soil structure, thereby sustaining the essential ecosystem functions performed by soils. The widespread cultivation of genetically modified herbicide-tolerant crops has increased the use of toxic herbicides, while harming biodiversity and endangering our wild bees and other pollinators. We've had the monarchs being knocked back because of this. Thank goodness some of those efforts are paying off now to, you know, really help make things better. They have gotten large increases in some of the monarch populations going on lately due to some efforts that have been made. And it's really great to see that, you know, we can change things. We can do it differently. We don't have to keep doing it the same way that isn't working. And we have teachers out there willing to show us the way. People like Janelle Kapoor, there at Ash Village Institute, with the Resilient Living School, programs that can help teach you how to craft your own sustainable life. It's very exciting. We can be doing that. The Resilient Living School is something that you can be part of. You can be part of classes at Living Web Farms. You can go to Organic Grower School. Of course, you can go online. There's so many ways to learn now. And it's about putting those skills that we learn in action and being able to take action every day in ways that are building that sustainable world that we can all share and celebrate together. So I'd like to welcome Janelle Kapoor to the show and to tell us more about the Resilient Living School and all of the exciting programs that are coming up this year. Welcome, Janelle.
Hi, thank you. It's nice to be here, Lisa. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you just great. You sound wonderful, and it was so nice to run into you there at the French Broad Food Co-op the other day. And I was so excited, as I'd mentioned to you, seeing that you had attended the COP21 conference in Paris. And it's always great to see things going on out there and some locals participating. And I would love for you to tell us about what you have planned for this year at the Resilient Living School and all the exciting programs you have coming up. And you have so many ways that people can participate.
Yes, I'm happy to share. Thanks for inviting me, and I liked our serendipitous meeting in the herb section of the co-op. What we're doing, and this is interesting that you mentioned Paris, because there were so many people there, obviously, to fight and speak out for climate change justice. And in amongst that, there's also this desire, rather than only fighting against a system, it's a desire to figure out, well, what are the solutions that we can do ourselves, rather than looking to the powers that be? How can we in our own lives really live it and do it? And so our programs this year focus on teaching a lot of skills that apply in that sense of personal empowerment, for incorporating real living skills on a daily basis. And so over the many years, we've worked with about 60 local teachers, and we've identified those that get the consistently best ratings from our participants, those teachers who have the balance of very practical skills and a really effective way of articulating and teaching, sharing their knowledge and their skills. And so what we have for this spring is the Resilient Living School and Resilient Living Workshop and Resilient Living Tracks. And all of that starts in April. So the school itself is an 8-month program, and that's our deepest dive with people who are coming from all over the country, and we've had applicants from other countries. That starts with an 8-week residency here in Asheville, and then it continues with 6 months of follow-up and practical application in people's own lives and in their own communities. And the main topics of that, and then each of these topics are actually concentrated into a week-long offering, which is early April, the Resilient Living Workshop. And extending into April and May, we have deeper dives that are short, like 3.5-day workshops, where people can come and focus on one particular topic. And those topics are organic gardening and urban homesteading practices. We have traditional food preparation, fermentation, and preservation. We've got eco-literacy, deep ecology, wild foraging, and botany. And then we also have a couple more. There's herbal medicine making and nature awareness, and homesteading, traditional, and living skills. And then we also have a focus on, in the school, consistent throughout the school, is a focus on transformative participation and personal inquiry. How can we create the more beautiful world that our hearts know is possible? And we're really blessed to have, like I said, some of who we consider some of Asheville's great teachers, and who we've been working with for years. And then we have the added benefit and honor of hosting Charles Eisenstein in that deeper personal and world inquiry. And Charles Eisenstein is the author of Sacred Economics and The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. He recently moved to Asheville. And in the year ahead, he's doing very few, only a couple public offerings. And so this will be one of them. So each of those programs is part of the 8-month school that starts in April. And then we've selected out, teased out sort of a 3-hour best of from each of those different topics that I mentioned. And that's concentrated into a week-long introductory workshop called the Resilient Living Workshop, which is actually almost full. So anyone who'd be interested in learning about that could go to, maybe we'll share the website at the end, but I'll just mention ashvillage.org, and you'll find in our program section the Resilient Living Workshop. And like I said, in April and May, each week is dedicated to a particular track amongst the topics that I mentioned. So it's a very exciting, dynamic, diverse program where the goal is for us in the longer program is for individuals who know that this is what they feel called to, who really want to cultivate their practical skills, and do so in a way that's in service to the world and in service to creating a culture and a planet that works for all. And for those individuals to come in and learn enough for them to identify what their next steps are and taking those next steps in a supported way. So the rest of the program, they're actually making a plan and doing it. Because, a lot of these programs, you'll learn, but then you kind of just go back to your life as it was. And in the many years that we've worked with people, what for us is the most exciting is when individuals come in, get really psyched about what they're learning, and then actually have the wherewithal to do it in their own lives. And we've seen that happen. We've had architects come in, learn natural building skills, and then go and start natural building businesses. We've had young entrepreneurs come in and learn fermentation skills and start their own fermentation companies. We've had folks come in and learn and then incorporate that into children's after school programs. And so those are just some of the examples of how we want to support people who are ready to integrate this knowledge and skill base in a in an applied way, in a real way. So that's who we're excited to work with, those who are motivated and really dedicated. And not everyone can take 8 weeks to do a residency and then the full 8 months. So we like to be able to offer the shorter options, the week long and the 3.5 day options for people who really want to do it, but don't have the time and space to do the entire program.
Well, every program is described in detail at ashvillage.org. And remember that little E in there, ashevillage.org. And you can check out Resilient Living School, the 8-month program, the week-long Resilient Living Workshop, Permaculture School for 12 months, design course for 2 weeks, and workshops 3.5 days. Lots of ways to participate. And like you said, mainly take those skills and put them into action, right? Because that's what makes us remember when we learn things, is if we implement it and then it sticks with us and then we grow into it. Oh yeah, but then if we leave it right after and don't put that rubber to the road, it's like, oh, what was it again, And so it's really great to see you bringing together people of so many walks of life from all over. I know you've had participants from many different places coming together and sharing the vision. And I love how you describe it here, vision of humanity living by the wisdom of nature in a way that honors and supports life in peaceful, thriving and celebratory cohabitation, because to me, that's the fun part. This is great stuff to work together as earth stewards to build sustainable culture, instead of just seeing it as all of our seemingly insurmountable problems, that we have these great opportunities to implement such wonderful ways of living again that promote health and wellness and happiness and celebration. So thanks for having such a great mission coming to life and inspiring others to do the same.
Oh, thank you so much, Lisa. Yeah, really appreciate you and all that you're doing and the opportunity to share this. And you mentioned the permaculture design course. That's a 2-week program that's certified. And so I focused on the resilient living programs, but that's also happening. And that's part of resilient living is really learning ecological systems design and permaculture, and to be able to offer that certified program. By the way, we're partnering on that permaculture course with Earthhaven and Permaculture in Action and the School of Integrated Living. So, it's really fun to be in a community where there's so much built-in knowledge and skill and to get to partner with each other in that way. So, yeah, thanks again. It's wonderful. I love all that you're doing and how you're sharing it.
Well, it's really fun. It's really fun when you start to plant the seed of gardening or maybe just committing to eating organic food or people committing to getting more native plant species out in their yard, whatever it is, getting people to plant that little seed of action and then to watch their life grow and bloom from it. And I was looking at your mission vision statement there. And, you know, sometimes when we're first starting or people have a dream of a homestead or creating a more sustainable, you know, living area or even building a new place or getting an old place and fixing it, it seems so daunting at first sometimes when you look at it and you have these great visions, think, where do I start? What do I do? And I just wanted you to perhaps share a little bit about the Ash Village Sanctuary and how you transformed what had been a very different place, right? A junkyard and a crack house. Tell us about the transformation at Ash Village Sanctuary.
Thanks. Yeah, I'd love to. And just to get a sense, how much time do we have so I can...
We can take as much time as we want, but we were planning on about 5 more minutes, but we could go a little further.
Okay. Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. So Ash Village Sanctuary is a site that is made up of 4 properties. We're right on the edge of downtown. It's privately owned properties in a neighborhood that's a few blocks from the co-op and the Orange Peel. And we're very blessed to be backed by 60 acres of public parkland that actually one of our council members back in the day, Robin Cape, helped to protect through a joint venture of protecting it and buying it so that it wouldn't be developed, so keeping open green space. And it's a beautiful wooded area that that we border, so we really have the best of all worlds here. And when we got the property, it was really junked out. I won't even describe all in detail what was going on here, but it was pretty nasty. And one of the houses was a crack house, and you could barely breathe in it. And so anytime I tell about what's happened here and what's transpired, I have to just start by giving thanks to all of those people who came and gave their time and put their hands into making this place what it is today. And we've been blessed with, you know, folks who just showed up for an afternoon to volunteer, with some also college groups and church groups. And then we've had real incredible designers from different parts of the country come in and add their expertise on designing the systems. We have a water system that catches about 30,000 gallons passively from rainwater and channels it into ponds and creates natural habitat and a lot of beauty. And just bringing water onto a landscape is always something that is a sacred process and a really practical process. And so that's part of the landscape here. We used a lot of recycled materials. So all of the wood for the posts and trellises, all of the courtyard using a lot of recycled and found stone, as well as what we call urbanite, which is a recycled cement pieces, busted up sidewalk, so that we're minimizing how much new stone from mining mountains by incorporating the urbanite. We've incorporated a lot of bricks from old houses. And then the landscape itself is, we've used biochar and taught workshops as we've gone in so much of what's happened here. So biochar and then pollinator landscape it's so incredible. I've just got to say, in the spring, summer, fall, when the pollinators are buzzing around, there's just bees and so many insects, and so you can hear them humming, and so many birds and so much wildlife too. I mean, incredible to see all the snakes and little lizards, and it's really fun to watch what a living, thriving ecosystem looks like and feels like and smells like. We've also added, the soul loves beauty. And so because we have so much food already growing here, we've also have a lot of room for flowers and colors. And it's really fun each year to just watch the site over the season burst into different colors. And and we've done some earthen projects because that's my background, and several others in this area doing earthen natural building. So we've retrofitted the houses with clay, plasters, and paints. We have a few small little earthen cottages. And what else can I say? I mean, there's so much it's what I'll say is this, is that the impetus to be here and do what we've done, and I say we in the sense of, you know, it's been a huge community effort over many years, and we have a small team that manages the site and then interns and volunteers who come and help work on the site. The impetus is that we can do this out on the land, outside of town. But, you know, I've been really inspired by the work of, for example, City Repair in Portland, Oregon, where they're actually bringing it into the city, into the urban center, where the majority of the people live, and where there's this big question of how do we create infrastructure? How do we design and plan for the greatest potential for ecological living on this planet in a city, in a cityscape? And while we're not in the heart of downtown, we're right on the edge of it, and we're in a neighborhood, in a regular residential neighborhood where so many people are living in the suburbs, in residential neighborhoods, in the city. And what if every person in their own backyards could do something like this? And even if they wouldn't do the entirety of what we've done, what if they can come and see what we've done and take one piece of it that inspires them as a next step? And so that was a huge motivation, because we can study and research them, but until we're actually living them, it doesn't mean all that much in my eyes. It's really when we put it into practice that I feel we're really taking the steps that are needed in the world right now. And it's not that hard. I mean, it's not rocket science. You know, it took us 5 years to get the basic infrastructure in, and it could have happened faster. You know, if all of us turned our attention to doing something like this, within a 5 years' time, we would have a different world. And while that sounds maybe too simplistic, it's actually true that if each and every person dedicated, and business and college and school dedicated itself, and government dedicated itself to creating real infrastructure based on ecological design and systems design, nature is resilient. Nature will grow and be the best partner we can ever imagine. We just need to show up for that. So anyway, that's it's wonderful to be living on a site that is that. And it's now, you know, now it speaks for itself. It took those years to build it, but now it really sings its own song, and that brings me a lot of joy. And I love watching people as they walk around the corner and come around the back and just feel like they're in a little slice of heaven. And it's a gift for all of us.
Well, it's really great that you've embodied the transformation of what had been sort of a junkyard and a rundown place. And, you know, I've noticed that a lot in the mountains. You'll have old communities that, you know, used the pretty part back by the creek to be the dump. And I've cleaned out some dump zones as well, and some heavenly places, and put gardens in. And it's amazing how quickly nature will transform things when we work together, learning and sort of being mentored in the process from nature's own patterns and intelligence. And it's so much quicker than we might think. And it's just wonderful. And you're right. If everyone really put that effort and we give it the time it takes, and we all just kept planting those seeds, we can truly make that transformation. And I think sometimes we get so inundated with messages of stultifying hopelessness out there in the mainstream media that we can forget just how dynamically synergistic it can be. And so thanks for having that be out there, that where people can sort of go there and have it be a crucible for their own personal creativity to take action. And I've seen pictures, but I would love to come and do a little tour and just see how beautiful. I've read something about the density of planting, and I know you have a ton of wonderful things planted to eat there, and just a 1 acre demonstration eco-urban little site there, Living Learning Laboratory. So great to see. I can't wait to come visit one day soon.
Oh, I can't believe you've never been here, Lisa.
I'd
love to have you. And yeah, when you come, one of my favorite things of all that I love doing each day is making herbal teas from the garden, and all the food that comes out of the garden, getting to share that with people who visit. And so we'll have to make a date and have you over. And yeah, and anyone listening, you know, what our favorite is to just get to bring people into these workshops so that they can learn and really make it happen in their own lives. So yeah, wonderful. Thank you again.
Yeah, well, plant the seed of action. Learn more there at Ash Village and Permaculture School, the Resilient Living School going on. So many ways to get engaged with this opportunity. And here's to having a wonderful year, Janelle. And I hope you get people inspired from all over the world to come to Asheville and share. And may they get lots of inspiration from each other, as well as all of the great information I know you'll have for them at the school.
Oh, thanks again. Yeah, we're really looking forward to a beautiful season and appreciate the invitation to share this today.
All right. Well, it's ashvillage.org. That's A-S-H-E village.org. Get on over there and look out. Look for all of the different ways that you can learn more this year and what the programs are. So great to have you today. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Ciao. Bye.
Ciao. Ciao. That is Janelle Kapoor of Ash Village Institute and the Resilient Living School. She is over there doing wonderful work. Check it out, ashvillage.org. She was hopping off to Paris to help in that conversation. A very, very dynamic local mover and shaker that I just had to get her on the show today. After I saw her, I'm like, you know, she does an amazing job of putting lots of great learning programs together, just like many of the things that we teach there at Living Web Farms. And so great to be able to share that today. And now we have Patrick Battle joining us for This Week in the Garden as we are swirling in a sunny polar vortex. Pat, are you keeping warm out there?
I am staying
warm. In fact, I was impressed. I was out there putting leaves over the garlic. I realized how deep the temperatures
were plunging. I didn't want our garlic greens to have to get the very depths of it. It already was 7 on the ground in the garden. And I was very impressed. I guess because I was working hard, it didn't feel like it was even 40. It was interesting. You know, the wind had stopped blowing. But normally in that kind of cold, I start wanting to go inside. But all you got to do is spread leaves, I guess, and you can stay comfortable.
Yeah, I heard the wind chill was below 0 last night.
Yeah, well, I mean, in our garden, I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't at 0 on the ground temperature in the morning. We don't have a way to measure that. At my house, which is well above the garden, so of course all the cold air is dropping down, and my little registering unit for my outdoor thermometer is on a downhill side so that the cold is hitting my house and going around it. So that's going to be a much warmer spot, a protected spot. It was 12 this morning, but I'm sure, I know in the garden, you know, I got one or two spots, you know, I just was checking beds where the garlic was to see what the temperature was, and one or two spots were registering 7. It ranged from 7 to 11 on the ground, and that was at about 8 o'clock last night. So, you know, it got way colder than that.
Wow. After that little bit of deep cold we had last week that wasn't quite as bad as this, but, you know, we were down into 12 and 14 zone early last week. I was letting those radishes go out there, black Spanish and the daikons started freezing. And yep. They started to rot in chunks of them, and I had to go out there and pull up the daikons. So now I have this big tub of white daikons and black Spanish. I have black and white going on. The black ones didn't seem to have any trouble, but boy, those daikons were freezing up like little icicles.
Well, that's because what happens is the top part freezes, and then the rot goes down from where it freezes, you know. And sometimes the cold travels down it, too. They stick out of the ground too far. The black ones probably are more in the ground, right?
Right, and sometimes I would have it be a part down low even. I'd go to pull one, and I would do a spiral when I pulled to help mm-hmm. it, you know, and it would be a chunk underneath could be rotten, or like you're saying, at the top, but it was spotty. But then the biggest, longest, most amazing one was perfect, and most of them were pretty good. But, yeah, they would have been hammered in the last couple of days if I hadn't have taken that evening to pull all those.
Right. The other thing you could have done was row cover in plastic, and then they would just keep cruising. You could leave them in, you know. The downside is if you leave the plastic on really bright, warmish days, which we sure had in December, you could start making those radishes a whole lot hotter because the temperatures will go up underneath the plastic, you know.
Right.
But if you're willing to just come out anytime it goes below 25 and pull plastic over beds that you leave row covered anyways, if you don't want to eat the greens, you don't have to worry about, you know, very much about the nitrogen, you know, especially if you harvest them at the end of a sunny day. And, you know, that can work. You can keep them going that way, you know.
Right. Still got lots of rutabagas out there. Got some Joan rutabagas, and I went ahead and had planted the East Ham turnips as well. So still letting those go. They were doing pretty well, but the greens on the radishes were getting pretty hammered. They were looking pretty rugged.
Yeah, you may see some damage to your, with the temperatures we just had, you may see some damage to your rutabagas and stuff too. I'd recommend row cover at least over them. All we have is row cover, and I'm hoping that works. I'm hoping it's enough, you know?
Yeah, they have row cover, but boy, those little round, little fiberglass, little round things, you know, that you put in the ground, they were snapping. Just pop, pop, pop lately.
Yeah. Well, they might be the quality. There was a recall on those.
Oh, really? Because I bought a huge stack of them over Fifth Season, and they've just been breaking left and right.
Yeah, I'd call up Fifth Season, and they'll put you through to Seven Springs, which is who supplies Fifth Season. I'm pretty sure that there was a recall. There was a bad batch. They should last you for years.
Oh, well, thank you, because you know what? It's been very, disheartening to walk out there every other minute. They've been breaking. I brought, like, you know, a whole bunch of them, and the whole stack that was there, and I wanted to really do it right. I went down. I got all this row cover stuff in the last, you know, few months, and was trying to really go for it this year with the row cover, and those things have been just snapping like toothpicks, and it's just like, oh my gosh, you know, and then those poor little greens under there with the row cover just on their head, you know, they don't like that, so thank you.
They take damage right where it touches, I'm pretty sure you can get some money back on that. I'm pretty sure. Probably what they'll do is just replace them. You
know? Yeah, I would just like some that work.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what happened, but there was a bad batch. I've heard that before, and I don't know anything about the timing or anything else, but if you have them breaking, they shouldn't be breaking.
Right.
You know, maybe after years and years and years of use, but they're designed to last for years, you know? And certainly the ones that we have here at the farm have been here as long as I've been here, and not one of them has broken, you know?
Well, that's a great thing to know. I thought, wow, this is just a bad investment to have to replace these every 5 minutes. Wonderful. That's good news.
Yeah. Not good news for anybody that didn't manage to get out there and protect their stuff last night. This will probably, if you didn't protect your greens, last night probably is the end of your outdoor green season, you know. Not impossible that some greens can still go, but, and indeed, we actually, because I was actually here on Sunday, but I had promised that I'd be up in CeeLo, and so I didn't take the time to cover. And I had last seen the temperatures predicted to be above freezing on Monday. And so I'd asked Jeremy to be sure and get out and cover all of the badly hit, but still, you know, plenty of greens to pick, collards and kales and some last final little cabbages and stuff. And I asked him to get those all covered, and he couldn't do it because by the time Monday came around, they changed the temperatures, and all of our row cover was stiff. It was all boards, you know, and so we would have had to, you know, go get another whole roll of row cover to cover stuff. So we just watched our stuff take that cold. And I think when I look at it on Wednesday, when we get back out of freezing temperatures, there won't be much left to it, you know. And then I have to report on something. This is a phenomena, and I hope there's a scientist listening that can explain this to me, because I am pretty dumbfounded by this. Last night, I was out covering, like I said, the garlic pretty late. You know, it was 8 o'clock, and I was still covering. I thought, I need to go harvest some greens out of the greenhouse. They won't be frozen yet, and I got to get them at the end of a sunny day. I'm out of greens. So I went into number 3, our biggest greenhouse, where we have kale and collards and pak choy and a whole bunch of good greens, spinach and things like that, lettuce. And I was wrong. Most everything was frozen. I was able to pick the leaves that were underneath the big leaves that had frozen on the spinach, and I got a nice little bunch of spinach to have with some eggs or something. And then I went looking for kale, and I could see that all of it was frozen except for about four or five plants right towards the worm box, towards the doors that we come into in number 3, our big greenhouse at Mr. Ed, Mills River Educational Farm. And I harvested from those, and then out of curiosity, I had my little infrared thermometer that I use for my wood-fired oven mostly, but I like to check out what's going on nights like last night too, and just see what I can learn. That's where I learned how cold the soil temperatures were. But my big thing was, I thought, okay, I'm going to see what temperature these leaves froze at, what temperature those leaves were in that greenhouse. All those frozen leaves were 22 degrees. That's pretty darn cold. What blew my mind, Lisa, and I still can't explain it, I'm hoping somebody...
I then decided to see what temperature the leaves of the
kales and the two collards that hadn't frozen were, and their leaves were also 22 degrees.
Whoa.
Isn't that inexplicable?
Whoa.
You know, I was kind of like really thrilled there was some there, because I remember what you had said about there being something bad in frozen greens, and I really was craving greens. I had to have my greens fixed. I was tickled to get them, and I took the temperature, and they Why weren't they frozen? They were the same temperature as the other leaves.
I wonder what that is. You know, years ago, I remember scientists doing a study on carrots that wouldn't freeze, and they were trying to breed in some of those characteristics into other type of, you know, production type vegetables so that they could, you know, get that quality of not freezing. And there were certain compounds. And so I'm wondering if maybe there's certain compounds in the way that kale metabolizes in those conditions where it will maintain a non-frozen state even at that temperature. I'm curious about that. I haven't heard of it having those, but now I'm thinking it must.
Well, but what's weird is, wouldn't that be scattered through the planting? Why would they all be in one spot? And then collards, only two plants didn't freeze, but they also were down at that end. It seems like it's a microclimate thing, but I don't get it. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. There's more mass at that end. You know, there's more heat radiating out. It's pretty insignificant, tell you the truth. But there's the furnace mass down at that end. You know, there's the worm boxes. There is more mass.
Huh.
And maybe that has to, right now when I think about it, that is the thing that, you know, so it might be a physics question rather than a biology question.
Right.
You know? But I'm flabbergasted. I don't.
Isn't that amazing how life, nature has just got all these little secrets waiting to surprise us and raise our eyebrows if we're just able to notice. And it's yeah. So great you're able to notice these little subtleties in there.
Right. Yeah. It's all. Yeah. For me, it's how I figure out how to make it work better, you know. So nights like last night are teaching nights for me. You know, I'm fortunate enough to have one of those little infrared thermometers, and I can just see what gets cold first and how things, you know, stay warm, where plants are warmer because there's a big rock or something like that, you know, what are the differences, you know, and there were significant differences all over the place. You know, I mean, temperatures ranged from 7 to some items of mass and some items that weren't even that big of mass. I really am a little flabbergasted that were like 22 still, you know. The temperatures were all over the place. And indeed, even in the heated number one greenhouse, which is heated very lowly, just enough to keep plants from freezing, there were spots that were already 36 degrees. I suspect that even with heat, there were spots in there that froze, you know. And so I think a bunch of it has to do with physics, less so plant biology, I'm suspecting. But I'm open. If somebody has an explanation, for me, either one, if I can understand the absolutely the mechanism, makes it easier for me to bring plants through the winter, you know. If we can ensure that if it's a question of mass isn't hard to come up with, you know. You can simply make sure you had a compost pile near your greenhouse near the plants that you wanted to have stay warmer. And if somehow that kept them from freezing even when the temperature on the leaves was 22, that'd be way worthwhile making your greenhouse more crowded for that time, you know.
Right, right. That compost heat recovery system webinar that we have on the website is very much details that and how he had amazing warm temperatures all winter long by doing that and didn't even have to use heating.
Right. That's a different thing. And indeed, you know, I have in Silo, I have now the greenhouse has come down and I'll put it back up. But I have a bin system and I grew my seedlings on top of compost. I'm actually saying it could be a pile of finished compost.
Uh-huh.
Just mass. And maybe that affects it. I don't know. I'm not saying it does. But the only difference I can think in that greenhouse, I mean, the truth is, I think actually that greenhouse slopes very slightly towards the area where these plants didn't freeze. So there should actually be more cold air where these plants were not frozen. But they're right next to those two big worm boxes. And that's a lot of mass, you know. And
right.
So that's why I'm wondering if it's mass, you know. They are not, there's no significant warmth in those worm boxes. You know, we don't put enough food in at once for them to get particularly warm. I mean, the worms are going to provide us a very tiny amount of warmth, but not very much. Really, they shouldn't be, it's not like they're radiating warm air at that, but they are massive. And so their temperature, they're going to hold more of the daytime warm air, which wasn't very warm, but it was certainly much warmer than, you know, 22 in that greenhouse. It probably was, you know, probably 65 or 70 in there when the sun was shining. Could have been 75 even, you know. We had it closed up. So they're going to hold that heat. But, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if, therefore, because they held the heat, the plants near them were warmer, You know, that's one of the tricks that people use to get rosemary to make it through the winter, is they put a couple of big rocks around it, you know, and that just slows down how fast it gets cold in that little microclimate. But that wasn't the case. The leaves weren't warmer, you know. So,
That's really, the mysteries abound, right? They abound. Remember I had that petunia a couple of years ago?
Yes,
that,
they do.
Yeah. When it was all surrounded by sidewalks and a concrete little shelf area where all the plants were in, and it just, I mean, a petunia? I never saw such a thing.
Yeah, no, that still boggles my mind that you had a petunia make it through the winter. They are so not hardy. You know?
Right. I mean, they're like, you blink at them with cold weather and they just go out. And so it just really goes to show how we can accumulate heat through these different kind of mass areas of whatever it is that accumulates, whether it's rock or maybe, you know, the concrete or various things. And I mean, I've had the little rock area here where even when it was cold, all the little lizards made their little colony in there because it was always warmer and they loved it. They know where it's at. Maybe, you know, if we could only stop and converse with them, they would probably have the answer on this mysterious way the heat is moving, you know.
Oh, we could figure so much out if we could have those conversations. You know? There are people that I guess are closer to that than I am, but I make no such claims, you know. I have not gotten to that stage at all.
I have gotten insects to kind of do things, you know, sometimes, like talking to a little spider. I particularly like those little velvety spiders. And I'll be like, hey, jump in this cup. Come on, I'm going to let you out. And I tell you, that spider will jump right in the cup just about every time. And they're so cute. They just, like, they can hear me. And I'm like, I'm not afraid. I'm just telling them, can you please get in there? Because you can jump and I can't catch you. So can you just jump in? And they just jump right in. And it really cracks me up. Or if I stand there in the garden, I focus on a butterfly landing. I've gotten the butterfly to land, you know, a few times. You know, I've had those moments. One time I stopped and talked to a hummingbird, and I said, you are so cute. Just calm down for a minute and rest. And I tell you, the hummingbird stopped, sat down, and just looked at me and quit flying for a minute. So I've had those moments, you know, and they're rare, but they're fun, you know. I leave the communication lines open. Hopefully, maybe, you know, maybe that'll expand a little bit, but.
Well, I hope it does, and just have a good list of questions for you. When you have your breakthrough, make sure, in case it's just temporary. You know?
Yeah. Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, I mean, it's heavy duty cold time, right? Dive into the seed catalogs. What else can we be thinking about doing? Maybe lining up when our starts get in order, right? What can we do this week in the garden?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we actually are starting plants today. We're starting stuff that we'll probably plant in the greenhouse for one big flush of greens. You know, these will not be long-lived plants. You know, they will be there for, oh, maybe, you know, 5 weeks or something before they're bolting. But they'll give us a flush of greens that will bridge the time from when our winter greens are going to seed and our outdoor greens, our winter indoor, you know, greenhouse greens are going to seed and our outdoor greens are not up to size to pick yet, you know. So we're starting those. We're also starting lettuce, you know, all greens, cooking and salad greens. So we're doing that. And also, Jeremy, I really love how thoroughly the entire farm has taken on farmscaping. Basically, we've gone from doing a kind of like rigid little bit of farmscaping here and there, and then my kind of advocating for individual spots, to everybody thinking, oh, we need to get our farmscaping plants going. And then just whenever they plant, they grab a handful of farmscaping plants and they take them out and they mix them in. You know, so it has actually just become the growing ethic of our farm. And that's just a delight for me because, as you know, I'm a huge advocate of that approach. And everywhere else I've been, I've had to just keep doing it myself and making it happen. It never really clicked with other people, you know. And here it's totally clicked. So I got down there today, and Jeremy had already started a flat of bachelor buttons, flat of poppies, the really gorgeous ones that are, you know, very delicate and stuff, and have loads of pollen. They get tons of beneficial insect. They're very ephemeral. They don't last very long, but they just really rock as far as the beneficial insects go. A flat of cilantro, a flat of dill, flat of parsley, just all these things that will go to seed at some stage and can be started now, can take the cold. It's going to get a flat of calendula going, all these things that we can put out in the deep cold and know that they will flower at some point. Some will flower pretty early, and that's real powerful for us. but it doesn't really matter. The sooner we get them in the ground, the bigger they're going to be, the better they're going to be. Oh, he's going to start a flat of chamomile because it also flowers real readily. And, you know, and all these things also are good at self-seeding. So getting them started early and getting them out there, oftentimes in the middle of the summer, none of us are that good about thinking about getting these things started. And we don't have enough successions. But very often, instead, what happens is our volunteers from our very early plantings are out there and they come along and we still get control. And so that's one of the things that we're doing today. And I recommend that. Also, any of the perennials that you want to have flower this year, if you have your system for starting things, and you can go to our seed starting video and see the different infrastructure that you can easily make for not very much money so that anybody can start seeds indoors right now. And if you get that stuff started now, any of those flowers, perennial flowers that you would hope to have flower in the second year, there's a good chance that they'll flower this year. They'll be able to get in the ground, have enough of a head of steam, and you might get flowers a year ahead of time. You know, and that's something that we're definitely doing this time of year is starting. And also herbs, you know, if you have perennial herbs that you need to renew or you have never had them before, we have a bunch of unusual ones that we need to get started. And indeed, some of these guys want to be stratified. They want cold stratification. So you can start them now and put them in an unheated place. Make sure you keep them moist and just let them freeze and thaw, and get that stratification. And then sometime in March, after they've had a good, you know, solid month or more of good cold stratification, you can put them in a warm greenhouse. It'll be easier to heat it then. Or you can even do just solar and have that much heat and get those to start germinating. So you can have all the great diversity of wonderful perennials. Now's a good time to get those started.
Well, it's certainly great to get that insight because, you know, you see people with these amazing gardens and you think, how did they get all that going so quick? And, well, they were in there starting them early and right. Getting them out there. And it makes for such an amazing garden. I've gone by some places and, you know, they just got all their stuff out after having it in. And you go by and you're like, what in the world? That's a miracle. How did all that grow? And yeah. When I first moved here and I didn't know the secrets, that's I used to just be amazed, especially at some of those old timer gardens, you know, way up in the country up in Madison County or places where people have been doing this for years and just being astounded at all of a sudden all that cabbage or all of a sudden all of that lettuce, you know, and that's the way to do it.
Yep, absolutely. I have some other news, by the way, about our good friend, the vegetable weevil.
Oh.
You know, I told you that I was moved to talk about it last week on the radio show because I had a call from Ben McCann at Goldfinch Gardens, or an email rather, and I helped them to ID it. They hadn't ID'd it yet, but I told them it was a weevil. And then there was a phone call to my phone in Celo, which I didn't get until much later, so I couldn't talk about it in the show. And he said, Pat, we have this new BT, and it is Bacillus thuringiensis galeria rather than Israeli. Israeli is the one that we use for cabbage worms and all that. This is galeria, and it's G-A-L-L-E-R-I-A. E-R-I-A-E. And it works on specific beetles, not all of them, fortunately. Otherwise, I would not use it because if it worked on ladybugs, I would not touch it, right? But so far, from what I can see, it is effective against the families of beetles that include Asiatic beetles, June beetles, Oriental beetles, and Japanese beetles. Those are all pests, all herbivores. And it also works on various chafers. I don't know the chafers, but apparently they are pests some people have. It works on the emerald ash borer, which is a major threat to ash trees. I'm sure it's the larva that it's getting there because the borer is a flying insect. I'm pretty sure that maybe not. It might be a beetle too. Yeah, it's a flying beetle, but I think it's more ephemeral. I'm pretty sure it'd be the larva you'd have to have the effect on there. But it also works on weevils, and they have a list of weevils it works for. The vegetable weevil's not in there, but they say the ones that have been proven it works on so far. So we're going to be ordering that, and we're going to be trying that, and then we'll have it in case we get a significant outbreak of Japanese beetles or June beetles or Oriental beetles. Those are the ones of those other pests that I mentioned that can sometimes be problems for us. So it's a new tool. It's exciting. It's expensive, by the way. It's more expensive than some of the BTs. We'll see how well it works and how long it lasts. And indeed, I did some searching for a wholesale source, and if it turns out to be a good source, I'll share that information. The purveyors that we found of the retail stuff are charging quite a bit. It basically, it seems like you could drop, you know, $40 to treat, you know, let's say about a tenth of an acre or something like that. And that's a little high. But for a backyard gardener, it probably isn't actually, because if it stores well, most of the BTs store quite well if you just keep them cool and dry, then you could make that investment. And for the little area you're having to protect, it probably would be worth it to go for it right away. For our bigger operations, I need to find the wholesale price and reduce that cost. I can't afford to go through the garden retailers. But it's pretty exciting, and it really makes it easier for us because we were having to use several successions of sprays, and some I don't like to use a lot of, like spinosad. Spinosad's hard on beneficials. This time of year, there aren't a lot of beneficials out there, but any beneficials there are out there, whether they be the stray braconid wasp or the overwintering ladybug that comes out on a warm day or something, I do not want to be hitting them with more broad-spectrum insecticides.
Right, right. Well, it's great to know about this Bacillus thuringiensis galeriae, a new one. Well, that's exciting.
Yep.
It's always good to know, especially because, you know, those the vegetable weevil.
Yeah,
they really devastate inside the greenhouse, right? Whenever you get the time that passes and they get to lay those eggs in there. Well, that is wonderful to know. And, you know, I've been really amazed at how much passive tillage with all these radishes. I've got such fluffy soil now. And, still have the moles running around tilling up everything and keeping it nice and fluffy, but keeping the greenhouse in balance, you know, it's like a challenge when you don't have all of the natural cycles going on in there when it's a little bit protected. So great to know that.
It's true. It is harder in the wintertime when there aren't as many beneficials out there. Oh, by the way, when you said moles, I realized that Jimmy Elizondo, of course, his native language is Spanish. He is from Mexico. And he was talking to us about the voles and the moles. And maybe I told you this last week, but I know that a bunch of people mix up moles and voles, and they forget which ones are bad and which ones are good. And Jimmy had that problem because it's mole-vole. I mean, if English is your second language and Jimmy speaks it perfectly, as far as I'm concerned, but still, of course, it's not going to be a go-to language for him to get every little nuance right. He was getting confused. He was telling us that it was moles that were going through eating these roots and spreading the mycorrhizae. And when I corrected him, told it was, he said, yeah, the mole vole, I can't keep it straight. If you have trouble with that, it's very easy. Think mole, meat, vole, vegetable. And you got it. You'll never mix it up again.
Okay. And those... The moles is what he was talking about, right? Or did he, was he?
No, it's
he
the
was
moles.
Talking
the
about
moles.
Moles
are the ones, they're eating the roots. Okay, so just in case we, you know, I assume everybody gets that the difference is that moles eat insects, voles eat vegetables.
Right, so the meaty little insects they're eating, the moles are eating the insects, yes.
Right, insects, they'll eat worms. I mean, they'll eat any small, you know, animal. You know, anything, if it's small enough for them to eat it, they will certainly eat it. They're not at all fussy. But they mostly thrive on worms and the larvae of beetles and butterflies. You know, things that are, not butterflies, I'm sorry, beetles, basically, you know. And possibly, I'm sure that if they came across, you know, parasitized Japanese beetles and stuff, they'd be taking out the wasps that parasitized that Japanese beetle, too, as they ate the Japanese beetle larvae. But just think, you know, insects are meat. Roots of plants are vegetables, and then you got it. The moles are the meat eaters, the voles are the vegetable eaters.
Right, and you were referring to him mentioning the voles' excrement actually putting the mycorrhizae in the soil, right? And he was seeing how the grass was growing better where the voles had been because of their ability to inoculate the soil with their excrement.
Yes, absolutely. That was exactly what he was saying, yeah.
That is so amazing. And again, us just... scratching the surface of what nature's doing out there, and we don't always know what's totally beneficial and what's not. You know, we can't just slice it all one way. It's pretty multidimensional there. Speaking of slicing, we've got the Pro Knife Skills Workshop tonight with Meredith at the farm, and looking forward to that one this evening, 6 to 7:30. Get registered, livingwebfarms.org, and join us this evening. It should be very interesting. I'm interested to learn about that.
Yeah, I'm going to go, actually. I have a fair amount of knife skills, but I think that Meredith has been, you know, if you're into the butchery business, you really have to know your knives. And so I expect that there's stuff to learn from her. I know that for the average home cook and stuff, that she's going to teach all kinds of basic knife skills that are going to be very useful. You know, I expect that a fair amount of what she teaches, I already know, but I'm fully expecting that there'll be a few tidbits that are going to, you know, ramp up my knowledge. So I'm really looking forward to it. I have a few questions to ask, and so I'm going to make sure and ask them. I highly recommend it. If you do come, folks, bring your knives. Bring knives that you know can be sharpened. Not the cheap kitchen knives that, you know, you just can't put an edge on unless you can take a grinder to them or something, and that edge is going to go away the first time you use them, you know. But if you have a knife that you know you can sharpen, bring it. And that includes paring knives. You know, it includes the range of knives that you can put a good edge on. She's going to be showing how to do that. She's going to be talking about how to use it. It's going to be quite a fascinating class. I know Richard Freudenberg's also planning on going. It's probably got, you know, a little higher attendance than we usually have of staff, you know. And that just is evidence that we all feel like we can, you know, ramp up our knife skills some. So, yeah, it should be an excellent workshop. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if she doesn't have to limit registration at this point. So if you're interested, I would sign up fast. I mean, you know, I know that I took several calls for her. I know she didn't have a very heavy registration to start with, but I've noticed a lot of interest since there was a mention of it in the Express. And I think that really got more people to understand that this is a shot right now. It's a great time of year to focus on your knives. You know, good time to, when you learn sharpening skills, to learn how to sharpen everything that you use in your efforts to be more sustainable. Because all of them, if it has a blade, it's going to be safer and more effective and easier on the tool if you can get that blade to its ideal sharpness.
Well, it's one of those cornerstone skills in the kitchen that can really make a big difference. And being creative, too, in things you make. I remember that appetizer thing that she made where she sliced the squash in a way I never really think of slicing it. You know, long ways, very thin, and made a rolly with it where you could make a roll. And it was, I was like, wow, I never thought of cutting that way. And so it'll be nice to get good tips, get the knife sharpened up, sharpen our skills, and also get some interesting little innovative techniques that might be helpful in the kitchen. It's just a great cornerstone thing. And, you know, cutting can really, really change preparation time. And so many people just fall into that, oh, I don't have time to cook thing. And then they end up eating horrible food because they're eating fast junk food that's processed. And if they could just beef up their prep time a little bit, they would maybe cook more often. So it's, I just see it as a great cornerstone skill. And, you know, I got my first real set of knives my dad gave me when I was 18 years old, Chicago cutlery with the black walnut, you know, base and all the handles. And, you know, I still have those knives 30 years later.
Oh, yeah. A good knife will last you a lifetime if you sharpen it right. If you sharpen it wrong, you can ruin that blade really fast.
Yep. And then this year, I went ahead after our last workshop that we did where she was talking about knives, and I really like a good sharp knife and being able to prepare things quickly, and went ahead and went down and got that brand. What is it? The German?
So any knife from Solingen, Germany. Hinkel.
Yeah.
Hinkel's the more common one.
That was, yeah. And I went on down to the kitchen store and got that knife. I got a 6-inch one. And so that's my only real professional knife. But at first I was pretty intimidated by it because it was so sharp. But what a joy to use. And I feel like it probably already needs some sharpening.
Yeah, no, it basically, she'll probably teach that. But it's good to have a good steel and to touch up your knife before every use. Just keep that edge nice and straight. It'll stay sharp a whole lot longer. And that kind of corrective work, which I'm sure she'll say tonight, avoids having to do, you know, more intense sharpenings, which always is taking metal off your knife.
Right.
You know, even when you use a steel, you're taking metal off. You're taking off micro amounts with a steel, you know. Once you have to use a stone, your knife gets smaller. My knife is now, you know, I had a knife. It was guaranteed. It was a Solingen knife. I think it probably was a Hinkel, but it might have been one of the other brands. Solingen, Germany, is where the best steel is for those kinds of knives, at least that I know of. There might be other places now in the world that have similar steel, but it's not so much the brand Hinkel, but just that location. So if you can figure out a company that's not making you pay so much for the name, they're using the same kind of steel, it should be the same quality knife. Anyway, I had one of those, and then it was guaranteed for life, and One day I dropped it and it broke in half.
Oh.
And sent it in and they sent us a new one. And that was probably in the early 90s. So my knife is that old, you know. And I can see now, there's, even though I'm very aware of being, where you mess up with knives, you know, is trying to sharpen them and not keeping the effort for sharpening them all the way to the very back of the knife. You know, the tip is pretty easy to make sure you get it sharp. You're real aware of that. But if you lay off it as you get to the very back, eventually you're going to get a curve in your knife. And my knife has a little curve where the back side now, you know, and it extends a little bit. I'm going to see if Meredith has any comments about how to fix that. But if I'm cutting really close to the handle, I actually have, you know, this little bit of the knife that is not contacting the board and not doing the cut. And that's from just imperfect sharpening. But the knife is now, you know, 20 years old, easy, maybe more like 20, 22, 23 years old, you know. And indeed, up to that time, before I broke that one, I had a non-stainless high-carbon steel knife. And that, by the time I finally replaced it, because I hadn't learned how to sharpen and avoid that as much, and now I have only a slight bit of that, that knife had quite a curve to it from that same problem. So I'm sure that Meredith will be addressing that issue tonight. And that's an important one to get a good idea on how to take care of it.
Well, that's great. And there's lots of good resources you can find. I've actually learned about some really good custom knife makers that have come into our area. And there's people that really will do a whole job on all your knives, professionally sharpening them. But getting those skills and learning about that tonight, hopefully there's still a little bit of room. Check out, see if you can register there at livingwebfarms.org. And of course, it'll all be on video for later. And you can practice at home and watch it again once that comes out at another time. But we look forward to seeing her tonight and learning more. Anything else you'd like to share with us, Pat, today?
Actually, a tip. A tip before she does the class. Twice last night, I came close to hurting myself with my knife. And why? I was preparing squash, and in getting the seed cavity out, I got that slippery stuff on my hand, and I was using one knife. Then I reached for my really good kitchen knife to cut it up smaller, my really good chef's knife, and I grabbed it out of the block, and it slipped out of my hand, missed my foot, but stuck a good quarter inch or so into the linoleum of the floor. So if my foot had been there, I would have been going to the emergency room. And it was simply because I didn't make sure that my hand was in shape to really hold on to a knife safely. And then moments later, I washed my hands but didn't dry them and went to chopping onions and had a piece of onion slip out of my hand as I was getting ready to bring the knife down. You know, and, you know, it wasn't like I wasn't chopping it. I was just cutting the end off it. But had my hand slipped instead of the onion slipping away from the knife and my hand slipped towards the knife, which would have been just as possible, I could have cut myself again. So making sure that your hands are good and clean and dry and don't have any slipperiness to them is a safety tip that I don't know if Meredith will get to tonight, but as I did it last night, I realized this is something I should share with the world. You know, twice in one night I came close to hurting myself simply because I wasn't taking the time to make sure that my hands were nice and dry and clean. I was trying to get a lot done in a hurry. I'd been out late. I wanted to get squash cooking and take advantage of using that heat to heat my house while I cooked a mess of squash. Plus, I wanted to make a dinner and just wasn't taking the time to be careful. That kind of care pays off in a big way. And maybe that's a little tip for the day, you know, focusing and getting your base stuff done right first, making sure that you're really prepared for whatever you're doing can avoid all kinds of other, you know, collateral damage or cost that can occur if you just try to skip some steps. Don't skip those steps. Do what it takes to be sure you're safe and you do your job right. And let's leave it there.
Okay, great. And the same thing on these wintry roads, right? Slowing down and being safe. I know there might be some ice out there now with all this cold weather, and hopefully it'll be safe rolling along there to the farm this evening. Look forward to seeing you and talking to you next week.
Okay, remember to bring your knives, folks. All right. See you tonight, Lisa.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That is Patrick Battle, and this week in the garden, talking about what we can be doing. And yes, you can actually be doing some things, but maybe not out so much in the garden, but getting them started indoors. Get your little germination chamber going. Check out the video. If you look up germination chamber in our search bar on livingwebfarms.org, that video will pop right up. Look at a way to start some salad greens, some cooking greens. Right now, have that little in-between flush of greens for spring before the real spring season kicks off. And right here as the winter is sort of pootering out, we've got a little spot where we can grow more greens. And of course, stay tuned for every week, getting the best tips you can to keep that garden growing all year long. We'll see you tonight at the farm. Talk to you next week here on Earth Heart Network Radio.